Nothing like the smell of the house when a good meal is cooking on the stove. Nothing like the smell of the trash can a day or two later when the wasted ingredients and sometimes the prepared food rot away in the trash can. We waste a lot of food all over the world, but especially in the United States. You'll hear how much from our guest who can see a pathway out of the waste. Dana Gunders wrote the book Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. She's the staff scientist in the Food and Agriculture Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. She spent lots of time on the subject matter and wrote a report called Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. Dana's work has been seen and heard on major media outlets, including the New York Times and NPR, among others. Dana Gunders, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So great to have you. Let's start with the NPR piece from last September. You can even use sour milk, it turns out.
It's true. Yeah, you know, in looking into how much food gets wasted out there, one of the key things that comes up is that people are kind of afraid of eating food past a certain point, including dairy products. And yet dairy is actually one of the safest foods out there because it's pasteurized. And so in the book, we do include some recipes. One of them is for sour milk pancakes, and you can actually use milk once it's turned a little bit and smells a little funny in baking, and it's really a substitute for buttermilk, and the pancake recipe that we have in the book is absolutely delicious, and you can't taste an ounce of bitterness.
I love the dedication in the front of the book. It looks like you've got kitchen efficiency in the blood in your family.
True. Yeah, my parents both grew up kind of with interesting backgrounds, but quite frugally. My father actually was raised in the Philippines, and my mom was from Queens, New York. Her parents ran a lamp store, and what that meant for me as a child is that I'd be sitting at the kitchen table, and I'd have friends over for dinner, and I'd be totally embarrassed because my dad would be like slurping as he sucked the last bits off a chicken bone, and my mom would pour water in the pasta sauce jar to get the last bits of the pasta sauce out before she poured it on the pasta and served it to everyone. So that's kind of my background.
It sounds like the kind of things I do, too. Yeah, especially the water in the pasta jar and in the salad dressings as well.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't until I grew up and started working as a scientist in food and agriculture that I really came to appreciate the mentality around saving food and realize just how much water and energy and land and time, people's labor goes into growing food. And to come to learn that, you know, 40% of all food goes to waste, it winds up being a huge waste of all the resources that go into growing food.
That is a pretty shocking number, 40%. As you point out, if you get 5 bags of groceries, you're going to put 2 straight in the trash, essentially.
Exactly. You know, we're so price sensitive in the store, and 10 cents can sway us one way or another. And yet, as soon as we get home, we sort of forget about all the money we spend on this food and don't really calculate that it's costing a lot. In fact, the average American family spends over $100 a month on food that ultimately they never eat.
Yeah. Also, and have you had a chance to compare this with elsewhere in the world? Are we sort of at the top of the food waste chain?
We are, and, you know, I think sometimes it feels like it gets old hearing about how Americans use more resources than other countries, but it's true in this case as well. The average American wastes, at the consumer level, about 10 times as much as somebody in Southeast Asia, and even a decent amount more than somebody in Europe.
So what is the most common cause of food going to waste?
Well, there are so many and different reasons, but really, I think if we have to boil it down to a few things in our homes, the reasons that food goes to waste, I think part of it is just sort of a lack of reality when we're in the store doing our shopping. I think when we are shopping, we're very aspirational, and we have plans to cook a lot and eat really healthy and serve healthy meals to our families, and then we get home and the week starts to happen, and by Tuesday night, you know, you're tired and maybe throwing a frozen pizza in the oven instead of making that fresh meal that you had in mind. And so there's kind of this mismatch that happens, and yet when we're purchasing food, we're still hoping that we're going to really be cooking more that week.
You know, I would have thought we've gotten better about this over time, particularly in the years since we started recycling just about everything else. But what's the actual trend on food wasted? Is it steady? Is it getting worse?
Actually, it's grown tremendously. We waste about 50% more now than we did in the 70s. And, you know, one of the trends that's grown alongside that, which I don't believe is a coincidence, is portion sizes. So, for instance, the average cookie today is actually four times as many calories as a cookie in the 80s. And similarly, a Caesar salad, a chicken Caesar salad, has doubled in calories. And a lot of that is just due to the sheer portion sizes that are being served. And there's only two things that can be happening with those extra calories. Either we're eating them, and that's not necessarily a good thing, or we're not, and they are going to waste.
And I noticed that the French fry serving size is different, like for McDonald's in America versus in the UK.
It's true, yep. A large here is actually bigger than a large in the UK.
Wow. Okay, so differences from country to country, too. More to talk about with Dana Gunders about the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about wasting food and how we'd like to reduce that. 40% of what we create for eating and consumption in America gets wasted at some point along the way. A trend pointed out by Dana Gunders once again in her book, The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food, showing us some ways to get out of that trend of wasting so much. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Dana about the subject matter. 800-838-3760 by phone, email. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about portion sizes in restaurants. Caesar salad is basically double the size it was a bunch of years ago. How what was once the large fry at McDonald's is now the small fry, that kind of thing. But these are restaurants. How are we doing with portion control at home, Dana?
Well, you know, not that surprisingly, portions have grown in our home alongside those in restaurants. One interesting thing is to look at the Joy of Cooking cookbook. There's been some studies that show over time the serving sizes that are recommended, you know, if it says a recipe serves 10 or whatnot, have grown over 30%. And so what used to serve 10 people now serves 7.
Wow. That's a difference. So how is the book arranged? Is it a cookbook? Is it a food handler's manual? All the above?
It's really meant to be a reference book, and it, you know, I call it a lighthearted kitchen reference book, and the reason for that is that it has a bunch of strategies to think about as you're shopping, as you're storing food, as you're organizing your kitchen, and as you're cooking and trying to use food up. It even has some ideas of what to do with your food scraps alongside, of course, composting. It also has ideas around science experiments you can do and parts of food scraps that can be replanted or used in household uses. So it has a bunch of chapters on that, and then it has recipes on how to use up different foods, both the sort of use everything in your fridge in one recipe kind of meals, and then also a few recipes like berry chocolate avocado mousse, where you can use up overripe avocados to make what's actually a pretty delicious avocado mousse, or the sour milk pancakes that we talked about before. So specific products that tend to go bad at home and that ways to use them up when they're kind of on the cusp. And then actually my favorite part of the book is a directory in the back where you can look up over 85 different products and learn very specifically how the products are supposed to be stored. So do tomatoes go in the fridge or do they not? Can you eat the green part of a strawberry or the skin of squash? And how do you freeze these products, and what can you do when they're a little wrinkly or have some spots, and ways to know if you can still eat them.
Okay, I'm dying for the answer on tomatoes already. That's one I can never quite figure out myself.
So the answer on tomatoes is, if you're going to eat it soon, they store best on the countertop, not in the refrigerator. Actually, putting them in the refrigerator makes them mealy. But if you're not going to get around to eating them for a long time and they're starting to go, then put them in the refrigerator, and at that point, they're better used for cooking.
So if they won't be used for, what, days or weeks or what? I mean...
You probably have about 4 or 5 days on the counter to use them. Mm-hmm. But if it's going to be any more than that, then the fridge is probably better.
Okay. One of the things you point out in the book, Dana, is that there's been a certain amount of kitchen know-how loss over the years. And I know that for the older folks, it's their parents. For the younger folks, their parents' parents. But grew up in the Depression and World War II and got used to getting by with not that much stuff, and that sort of permeated the childhoods of the boomer generation anyway. But it seems like those didn't get picked up by that generation and passed on.
It's true. I mean, when you look at the difference in, for instance, what portion of our budgets as Americans average was spent on food, back during the Depression, it was over 25%, whereas nowadays it's actually 10%. For the average American. So really the kind of financial incentive has gone down, and for the most part, food is fairly abundant for many people. Now, of course, there are about 1 in 6 Americans still who are considered food insecure, and for whom that is not true. But for the rest of the country, there's kind of this mentality that food's around and you're hungry, you can just go get it, and there's not a huge drive to really save it or think about how much it took to get it to our plate and really sort of treat it appropriately.
Dana Gunders is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, staff scientist in the Food and Agriculture Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, author of Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Dana, you say all waste is not equal, meaning what?
Well, when you throw out food, you really throw out all of the energy and water and resources that went into growing it, and that's very different for different foods. So, for example, if I were to throw out a hamburger, that would be the equivalent of taking a 90-minute shower in terms of the water required to produce that hamburger. If I were to throw out an egg, it would be equivalent to about 11-minute showers worth of water. So, depending on the food, you know, the more resource-intensive it is, the more impact it has to waste it. And just to give you a sense of what the impacts are of wasting food, in the U.S., approximately 33 million cars' worth of greenhouse gases are produced to grow food that ultimately never gets eaten. And about 25% of all the water in this country goes to growing that food that ultimately gets thrown out as well.
The amount of water that is consumed by cattle, though, that turn into hamburger, that's amazing. 90 minute shower. Is that for all the hamburgers or just for the one that you got from that particular animal?
Just for the, well, for about, a, you know, sort of an average for about a quarter pound hamburger.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So what are the effects that you track from food waste? Where does it go, for example?
Well, the large majority of it goes to landfills. And only about 5% of all the food out there gets composted. The rest does go into the regular waste stream. And food is actually the number one product entering our landfills today.
Really? Above anything else?
Above anything else. And when it gets there, of course, it rots, and that creates methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, and has impacts there. And also, it doesn't get recovered, so there's a lot of good nutrients in food scraps. And when you compost, you're able to recover those nutrients and use them in your garden. When it goes to the landfill, of course, we can't do that.
So Section 1 of Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook is about sage shopping, and it involves actually making some plans before you get to the grocery store. Tell us about your own struggles with meal planning, Dana.
I will. You know, meal planning is always cited as one of the best ways to avoid wasting food. And that doesn't have to be sitting down on Sunday night with a cookbook for 2 hours and planning your meals. But it does mean giving some thought ahead of time to what you're going to eat, which ingredients you already have, which you need to have, and creating a shopping list. Of course, that requires a certain amount of organization. I personally am fairly organizationally challenged, so I tend to struggle with really being organized about that. And I have a few shortcut methods that I like to use. One is to just acknowledge that I'm going to have some lazy nights in my week, and so I tend to just plan about 2 meals for the week, and I'll cook a little extra so that I have leftovers because I'm willing to eat them. Not everyone is, but I'll just plan a couple meals and acknowledge that I have some lazy nights during my week and that they do happen. The other trick I like to use is that when I'm checking out of the grocery store, I'll take a minute to look back into my shopping cart, and I'll go item by item and try to identify when during the coming week I will actually eat that food and plan out a time. You know, is that Wednesday's dinner? Is that Tuesday's dinner? And if I can't identify a time when I'll eat that food, then I may decide not to buy the product that week, just acknowledging, you know, what that week's going to look like.
And then, of course, it helps you decide when you get home, I'm going to freeze this, I'm going to keep this fresh, that sort of thing.
Yes, and I think, you know, for those of us who are not great planners, planning is still the best way to go. There's a lot to show that people who plan and use shopping lists actually have lower grocery bills and lower waste. But if that's just not in your DNA, there are, you know, some other methods that you can use that I personally have gotten very good at, and that's freezing food. I think we vastly underutilize our freezers, and you can pop food into a freezer just for a week or something. It doesn't have to go in there for months, and it's really like pushing the pause button, and so many foods can be frozen that people don't think can be frozen, like milk, cheese, beans. In some cases, textures will change, and it's better to use them in cooking when you've defrosted them, but I certainly encourage freezer use.
We are talking to Dana Gunders about her book, Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food. And here's a call from Donna in Florence. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask about, it seems to me that people don't mention enough about Costco. And being from a retirement community like Florence, there is a lot of people here that I know of that go over to Eugene to shop at Costco, and they buy an enormous amount of food, and then they bring it home, and they fill their refrigerators and their freezers. And a lot of that food ends up being food waste. And Costco was originally set up as a
wholesale kind of store, yeah.
Wholesale.
Yeah.
Wholesale store, and when it turned into retail, it seems to me like people are kind of forced, people that buy there are kind of forced to buy in threes and fours and cases and more food than they can possibly consume. And my question is why you don't hear enough about that you know, shopping at Costco isn't, number one, sales-worthy, because, you know, when is a sale not a sale? And it's not a sale if it's something that you really didn't need, but you bought it because you were getting a really good price on a six-pack of, you know, say, a six-pack of lettuce or any kind of produce item, and then you end up throwing that away later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point to bring up. Thanks for that, Donna. Very much appreciate it. So I think give us that idea of things, Dana, that view of things where we're with some of these larger stores, we're being encouraged to buy larger numbers of things.
Right. I think the caller is absolutely right. You know, it only saves you money if you actually eat the food. And a lot of that food does go to waste. I think the best thing to do if you are somebody who does shop in those stores is, one, to be really careful with any perishable items. She mentioned lettuce. It's really hard to use 6 heads of romaine lettuce. So I'd be very cautious when buying perishables there. And also to plan into that trip a little time when you get home to really kind of process what you've just purchased. So maybe you bought a whole bunch of chicken breasts. Well, make sure that you take the time to separate them into the right portion sizes that you'd want to defrost, and then put them in the freezer and store them well. Store them so that they're protected from air and don't get freezer burn, for instance. And also make sure that you can see most of the items that you purchase, because I think a lot of times people will go to those stores and all of a sudden stuff gets shoved back into the back of the pantry and it's still there a year later.
You had a remark in here about refrigerators, and I think it was actually freezers, about they're great places to hide things.
It's true. I mean, I think many people have had that experience of cleaning out their fridge at the end of the month or whatnot and finding things they forgot were in there. And certainly the freezer acts as a nice place for things to go for months at a time for some people. I think the best way to deal with that is to, well, for the freezer, be organized. And if you can have a whiteboard that's actually on the front of your freezer to keep track of what's in there, that can be a really handy way to remember what's there, but also to label things and to keep things in clear containers when possible. In the refrigerator, one nice trick is to have a little basket or tray that you have up in the top shelf there that is sort of a needs-to-be-eaten-soon tray, and you can even put a little eat soon sign on it and go through your fridge every so often, every couple days really, and put foods that need to be eaten soon into that place, and that'll help you remember to eat them.
Dana Gunders is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. A couple of things about what to put on that shelf, and in fact, things to buy for it. You write about buying funny fruit at the store. What are funny fruits?
Well, funny fruit are either fruits or vegetables, really, that don't look perfectly perfect. Maybe they have a little scar on them. Maybe they're a funny shape. And the reason to buy these products is that when you think about it, you know, not all oranges grow perfectly orange and perfectly unscarred on the tree. Some may have a little yellow color, for instance. Some may have a little scarring. They're perfectly fine. They taste great. They're nutritious. But oftentimes they actually get wasted either on the farm or somewhere along the way getting to our tables because they get picked over and they are basically not bought because of their cosmetic imperfections. So being willing to buy some of that funny looking stuff or just slightly off color or misshapen products can really help utilize all of the food that we're growing on farms.
We touched on some of this already about care and feeding of stuff in the refrigerator and freezer. There's a whole section here on smarter storage in which you basically proclaim us experts on microbes within a page. What are some of the major points about essentially how to handle our foods in ways that don't encourage the growth of microbes and ultimately make us sick?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, food, generally speaking, when food gets old, you know, bacteria and the enzymes tend to work on it, and that's a very natural process of aging. Things like oxygen and moisture help that happen. So there's no moisture, for instance, in pasta, and that's why dry pasta will last so long. And doing something like storing your food in airtight containers and making sure it's very airtight can limit the amount of oxygen that gets in there and can limit the aging process for those foods. It's also really important to understand that when people get sick from food, when you hear about E. coli or Salmonella outbreaks, those are really a different kind of pathogen, a different kind of bacteria that can get on food and contaminate it somewhere in the process of that food getting to you. That's a different situation, and it's different bacteria than food aging. So when food is just old, as long as it's not contaminated, it's often still okay to eat and not going to make you sick.
So, in the midst of a confessional here, if it smells a little off and you stick it in the microwave on high for a minute, are you pretty much going to be okay?
Pretty much, yeah. And most foods, that is going to kill off whatever, you know, any kind of thing that could potentially be on it. And again, as long as it was never contaminated in the first place, which most foods are not, you'll be fine. Now, let's take this within reason, right? Our bodies are very well equipped to know when we shouldn't eat food any longer because it's aged. So if it's slimy, if it smells bad, if it looks really off, then by all means do not eat that product. But don't be scared of some tasteless, sort of sightless thing that you think might be in the food, because you're quite well equipped to identify.
Which is a major point in your work, is that don't just go by the sell-by date, because it's often not particularly effective.
That's true. Yep. Sell-by dates do not mean the food is bad. They're not telling you to throw it out. They're really just a manufacturer's best guess at when the product is at its peak quality.
Right. But if, in fact, your head snaps because it smells so bad or is that slimy, then that's probably a good indication you want to skip that one. Dana Gunders is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange with the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. We'll come back and talk more with her and take more of your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dana Gunders, a staff scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council and the author of a book called Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, a guide to eating well and saving money by wasting less food so we can stop being the Americans we are and wasting 40% of what is produced for people to eat in this country. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone and by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Gunders.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Dana.
Howdy.
Well, a couple of random thoughts here and a question for the author. First of all, Twinkies are the wonder food because their shelf life is seemingly infinity, but you can't really make too many recipes with a Twinkie, so it's kind of a non-starter when it comes to flexibility.
I actually have a Twinkie cookbook, but we'll talk about that a different day.
Okay. Well, here's the second random thought. If you could judge your food as you would judge putting gasoline prices, you know, gasoline in your car, I think more respect would occur with regard to wastage and usage of food. And, Dana, here's the serious question. Let's speculate about this. In the future, are they going to have such things as smart refrigerators, smart freezers? How about smart food that could interact with the refrigerator so that any person walking into their kitchen could glance at the front of the refrigerator or the freezer and see at a glance what food would be most well used in a recipe and which food would most be well just left lying around inside of it? And, Jeffrey, let's take the responses of that.
All right, great. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it. Dana, thoughts?
Sure, yeah. Well, already there are certainly apps, right, out there to help you kind of manage your food and figure out what needs to be used up first and give you recipe ideas for that. There are a number of them out there, and so a quick search would find them. But I agree. I think the smart refrigerator is hopefully not too far away. There are some models out there today which are a little disappointing that are just kind of an iPad on the front of a refrigerator, essentially. But the refrigerator of the future is something I get very excited about. You know, I think there's opportunity to do things like have different zones in a refrigerator that could actually help preserve your food for longer, just like you have the bagged lettuce these days that helps lettuce last longer because there's less oxygen and less moisture in those bags. Why not have a drawer that seals and could have less oxygen and moisture in there? And different foods are best stored at different temperatures. So why are our refrigerators only two temperatures? You know, what if there were four different temperature zones so that we could store it at the right temperature? And what if our freezers were a little bigger so it actually helped us freeze more food and you know, have smaller refrigerated portions, because really we typically can't get to all the food that we can actually store in that refrigerated portion.
The level of detail in the book is truly impressive, particularly as you walk us through our refrigerators. And so, for example, you tell us about something that I think a lot of people, I'm unclear on anyways. What exactly goes on in the crispers?
Yeah, those funny crisper drawers, right? You know, when I started writing this book, I started to realize that there's more design behind a refrigerator than most of us give it credit for. And those drawers just seem to be where you throw whatever, but actually there is some intent behind them. They create a different humidity zone in the refrigerator, and that's good for fresh vegetables like lettuce and broccoli and things that might wilt, because it helps, you know, maintain a little more moisture and it helps them keep their structure. However, the best way to use them is to, if you have two drawers, separate vegetables that might wilt, lettuce, broccoli, carrots, from other things that tend to rot more, like most fruits and peppers and mushrooms. Those products, fruits, actually do better with a little more aeration. And so if you set one drawer to high humidity and put those potential wilting products in there, and one to low humidity, or crack it open a little bit if you don't have a lever, then you put the fruits in the one that has a lower humidity.
It makes sense that it's going to be colder on the bottom than on the top, but you also point out that the door of the fridge is often warmer. So, for example, even if your dairy products, like your milk, fits in the door, should you not put it there?
That's true. Dairy products should not go in the door. You know, every time you open that door on a fridge, it gets a blast of warm air. And so really, it's only good for things that are pretty stable, like your condiments. A lot of doors have little egg compartments in it. That's really a mistake. Eggs should be kept in the main part of the refrigerator, not in the door.
Oh, really? Okay, that's a good one to know. And I noticed that you were pointing out in a piece on NPR, I think back in September, about the fact that eggs, for example, can be good long past the use-by date, but there's a simple test, a water test for eggs.
That's true. Eggs can typically be eaten about 3 to 5 weeks longer than the sell-by date on them. But if you're unsure, you can take eggs and put them in a bowl of water. If they sink, they are still good to eat, and if they float, they are not. And that's because over time, air can start to enter into the shell, and that'll make it float once it's bad.
We have a question here from Joy and Talent, who says, I'm confused. How is it that portion sizes are 30% larger, but food costs per person are down? Is food just that much cheaper than it used to be? Or just a less of a, I mean, you mentioned it's less of our income now than it was.
It is less of our income. That's right. I mean, part of that has to do with sort of the drop in commodity prices around the world and increased globalization of food and the strength of the U.S. dollar relative to other parts of the world. So there's sort of a complex answer to why food is cheaper. And, you know, portion sizes are big often in restaurants because food is relatively low cost for those restaurants as compared to things like the rent they're paying and what it costs to pay their staff. And so they'd rather charge a little more for a plate and be able to get a little more income and, you know, serve you a big old plate of pasta that doesn't really cost them that much in terms of the actual food.
Okay, so back to practices in the kitchen, and we talked earlier about kitchen know-how loss and some things that previous generations might have done, like canning, pickling, and drying, but you include those in the book. Now, for the folks who are already hyperventilating at the thought of doing some of these processes, what's a good starter project, Dana?
You know, I think making basic pickles is actually a great starter project because it's so easy. The first time I pickled anything, I couldn't believe how easy it was. You know, it's the essentially what you're doing is cleaning your jars, cutting up some vegetables, putting them into jars, and then boiling some salt water with some spices and putting it into those jars. It's that easy. So I certainly encourage people to give it a try, even if it seems a little intimidating.
Okay, so pickles to go. I mean, the crafty kitchen is a whole section of the book in which you say your kitchen should make you want to cook. So what are some ideas for making it inviting in that sense?
Well, certainly just having it be kind of a clean, organized place where your different kitchen equipment is accessible helps to get out there and actually use your kitchen, right? If you have to go in and dig through three other appliances to get to your KitchenAid mixer, you're probably not going to use that very often. I think having a blender handy is really useful because a lot of times when fruits are getting a little older, they can be great in a smoothie as opposed to being eaten fresh. So that's certainly one piece of equipment I recommend having close by. Another that I really love having is a pressure cooker, and that's because pressure cookers really reduce the time it takes to cook a lot of food, and often it's a lack of time that stops people from cooking.
What kinds of things are best cooked in a pressure cooker?
Beans. You can cook fresh beans in a pressure cooker by just soaking them for 1 hour, and then it only takes about 10 minutes to cook them in a pressure cooker, which is much less than having to soak them overnight and cook them for 2-3 hours.
Wow, that otherwise. Is a big difference. What are some of the items, the other things that you might give in the tenets of mindful cooking about reviving older food? I mentioned that I see that you mentioned it here.
Yeah, well, you know, some of the things I talk about in the book are just some of the basic mentality to have in mind when you're cooking. You know, one is that food, even if it's past its prime, can still be used. You can, you know, if a carrot isn't looking that fresh, well, then don't use it as a fresh product, but instead try to cook with it, put it in a soup, do something else with it. But there is sort of a sweet spot in there where you can actually revive food that's starting to get a little bit older. If you soak lettuce or carrots or broccoli that are wilted in a bowl of ice water for about 5 to 10 minutes, you can actually re-crisp it. Now, if they're sort of very, very wilted, that won't work. But if they're just starting to get soft and wilted, it will work quite well. Another way you can revive food are stale crackers or stale tortilla chips can be put into a toaster oven, toasted for just 1 to 2 minutes, and that will actually crisp those products right up once they've cooled.
There's a whole section I noticed based on kitchen crises, and it sounds like step one in any crisis is just not to panic.
Well, that's probably true no matter what. But yeah, you know, we've all had that situation where we put too much salt in because we thought we were using the teaspoon measure and instead we were using the tablespoon. Or you forgot about something and on the stove while your kid was screaming or the doorbell rang and you come back and you've burnt the bottom of the pan. So, you know, I mean, again, don't panic, as you say. We have all sorts of tricks in the book for what you might do in those situations.
For example, go ahead.
If you've over-salted a soup, you can put a potato in it, and actually that potato will absorb some of the salt. And you can either leave that potato in, or if you would prefer, you can remove it, and that will take out some of the salt.
What about the old honey, I burnt the roast situation?
Right. Well, it kind of depends how badly you've burnt it. I recommend taking it off the stove immediately, putting it into another pan of cool water if you can, and trying to sort of cut off the burned part at the bottom, if it's at the bottom, or at the top, if it's at the top, and get to the insides, which may not be quite as burned. If it's something in a pot, you can try, and it's not too burned, you can try putting a damp cloth over the pot, and that can absorb some of that burnt taste.
You know, you're really big on leftovers in the book, and in fact, even advising us to cook enough to have leftovers. What are some good practices there to ensure safety, though, to make sure that you're gonna live through your leftovers?
Well, leftovers can safely be eaten definitely for 3 to 4 days and often for up to about a week. Of course, the longer it's in there, the more you want to make sure that you heat them very well and make sure they get up to a high heat for, at least 20 seconds or so to really kill off anything that could have been in there. And I like to really use leftovers in other recipes sometimes. So if I saute some vegetables as a side one night, I'll use them the next night, and I'll actually sort of cook them into maybe a stir fry or put them even just in a soup that I'm making. So I like to get really creative, and it can be fun to just sort of unleash your creativity in the kitchen and think, what could I do? What would happen if I combine these two things?
Right. The old fusion in the kitchen thing.
Exactly.
The whole process of figuring out how best to use your kitchen and be more efficient with it, it seems like you're giving a final exam, though, when you talk about meal planning for parties. Wow, that's a whole new level of complexity, isn't it?
It is, and I think parties are one of those places where we just wind up with so much extra food at the end of it, because the worst thing is if you run out, right? And so we really tend to go overboard. And it's also a situation where we're cooking in quantities we're not accustomed to, so we don't kind of have it down. Some of the things I recommend for parties are certainly using a portion planner. You know, there are calculators you can find on the internet, and just multipliers for recipes. But you should realize that, you know, if you're having 20 people over, you don't need to make 20 of every single recipe necessarily, because you often have more items than you would typically have if you were just serving that product. So make a little less servings, and also freeze in batches and reheat as needed during the party. And then make sure to have leftover containers available so you can send all your guests home with what is likely to be some extra food at the end of the party.
Here again, make good use of the leftovers. One of the many major points in Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food. Dana Gunders wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Dana, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Have a great day.